Welcome to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's a big year for some of Woods Hole's most treasured institutions. The Children's School of Science is celebrating its centennial year.
But there's so many shrimp in this tank.
We have nets.
Wait, aren't shrimp arthropods?
There was an amphipod. Some type of amphipod, I forget what type. A pipefish, a seahorse, salicornia, and eelgrass. I really like marine biology and CSS. I really like the field trips. My favorite one was going to Penzance Marsh. Wherever you looked, there was a fiddler crab. You had to see at least one everywhere you looked. It was really cool. I'm going to try to get into ROV in a couple years, remotely operated vehicles. Because I'm really interested in engineering and robotics, things like that.
Yes, we're seeing these fish.
The seaweed is putting out, what's it called again, stuff? Carbon dioxide.
Oh.
I mean oxygen.
In the squid dissection, we took out the pen and wrote with it. In the fish dissection, I found a half-digested crab in my fish's gut.
Did you guys catch stuff?
Yeah. Quite a bit.
Like what?
Scup, sea bass, a couple interesting things like flounder.
Pufferfish.
We got a pufferfish.
Well, it was a lot of fun because we got to go a lot of places, muddy places, and catch snakes, amphibians.
To help us learn more and give us more opportunities to learn about marine animals and plants.
This is one of those meadow katydids, and we found one in a grassy field area.
That's butterflies, right?
Lepidoptera.
Yep. They have scales on their wings.
They have small scales on their wings.
Spiny skin.
What is this?
And turn it over.
It has the 2 feet.
And radial symmetry.
Radial symmetry.
Iconic school bell that we hear here in Woods Hole during the summer. Later this hour, we'll talk with Mary Ulbrich from the School of Science. But first, the Marine Biological Laboratory, or MBL, is even older than the School of Science. It's the oldest continually operating independent marine lab in the country, and it's celebrating its 125th anniversary this year. In addition to the typical celebrations, MBL is launching a new affiliation with the University of Chicago. Dr. Gerald Weissman is Emeritus Professor of Medicine, Research Professor of Medicine, and Director of the Biotechnology Study Center at New York University School of Medicine. He's also editor-in-chief of the FASEB Journal and author of several books about the history and culture of science, most recently Epigenetics in the Age of Twitter, Pop Culture and Modern Science. And of course, Dr. Weissman has a long history with the MBL. He's taught the renowned physiology course and served as both a corporation member and a trustee. Jerry, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, let's go 125 years back, and maybe even a few years beyond that, to the founding of the MBL. What was going on in Woods Hole that made it such an appealing place to start an institution like this?
Well, let's start with that lead-in of the Children's School of Science. The MBL actually is the offspring of two Children's School of Science, the Penikey School and the Amisquam School. Let's get back to who really started this. It's all due to Elizabeth Cabot Cary Agassiz, the wife of the great naturalist at Harvard. She thought that it would be a good idea to have a summer place where high school teachers of science, because science was suddenly required by the Massachusetts curriculum.
So science hadn't been a part of school curricula before this point?
It hadn't been enforced. And so she thought it might be a good idea for science teachers to have a practical, hands-on experience. So when her husband, Louis Agassiz, came back from one of his trips in 1872, she said, "Some of your younger associates," and also herself, she confesses, "suggested that maybe we ought to build a school of science somewhere in the Massachusetts coast." Agassiz was good at raising money, so he appealed to the Massachusetts legislature in an open letter, published in a newspaper. That was seen by a New York philanthropist named Anderson, and lo and behold, the next summer, the Penikey's Island School of Biology, which was called the Anderson School, was founded. It pretty much worked like a school of science that you just heard about, only for high school teachers. And among them, that first group in the Penkeys Island were people like Alpheus Hyatt, Cornelia Clapp, and C.O. Charles Otis Whitman, who then became the first president of the MBL.
And we now have a building at MBL named after C.O. Whitman.
And a street named Hyatt, etc. Okay, that was 73.
So we're not even up to the MBL founding.
What happened right. in between? Unfortunately, Agassiz died the next year, and the school did not continue. But spurred on by the experience of the Penkeys School, Alpheus Hyatt moved a teacher's school and training school for the observation of biological specimens on the coast. He moved it up to Amisquam, up the coast. And then came Woods Hole. How come? Well, in the early 80s, Spencer Fullerton Baird, and there's a road named after him, of the Smithsonian, was put in charge of the fisheries. And he was charged to do the ecological work on how fish moved up and down between the northern and southern coasts of the United States. Where did they go through? Woods Hole. So they established the fisheries as that study section. There were not really experimental labs set up, but observational labs. That was the first echo center, really.
Well, and we actually just spoke about this on the show last week, the fact that Spencer Baird established what is now the oldest operating aquarium in the country, which is our Woods Hole Science Aquarium as part of that lab.
Exactly. However, he also purchased land right opposite the fisheries. Now come the MBL. It turns out that the Women's Educational Association and the Boston Natural History Society got together and decided that Hyatt, because by this time his colleague and friend and boss, Louis Agassiz, was long dead, Hyatt then decided together with the Women's Education Alliance to move down to Woods Hole, and Spencer Baird offered the space to him. That's a bare small town, very few trees, but the fisheries were there, Spencer Baird was there, and the Women's Education Alliance in 1887 decided to put buildings up opposite the fisheries. So the first 2 years, the two institutions were one. But after that, it took off, and now I think we're possibly one of the most exciting centers of experimental biology in the world.
So we're talking now in the corner of Woods Hole. For those who have been here, if you go all the way down Water Street and are kind of looking out into Great Harbor, on the left, there's a brick building that is fisheries and the aquarium building there. And then to the right, there are some brick buildings that are MBL. Those are the original buildings?
Nothing was brick at the time. It was wooden.
So that's been built since then.
Exactly.
Now, the rest of Woods Hole at that point was quite industrial, right? I mean, Woods Hole had a history of being a port for guano, for fish. There were fish processors. I mean, all these beautiful houses that are out on Penikey's Point now, that was all industrial area, right?
Yes, but industrial is not quite the word for it. Industrial would mean factories. This is fishing, farming, processing, and bear. If you take a look at the pictures of the time, we happen to live in a house that was built on the hill where Whitman lived, bare, no trees, nothing. And Woods Hole was pretty empty, a few houses, and the industry was local, farming, tilling, guano manufacture out of Penzance, and that was it. The big action were the fisheries.
Now, there's a building at MBL that's one of the administrative and teaching buildings now, the Candle House. What is the origin of that name of the Candle House?
Wax was made there. And what does one do with wax? One makes candles. Where did the wax come from? Fish in the sea and big ones like whales.
Now, you've taught in the physiology course. This is one of the best-known courses that MBL runs of all of the different classes that are run over the summer at MBL, and I believe one of the oldest as well. Why physiology? Why was that kind of what got MBL started?
Actually, there are several things that got the MBL started. Physiology was one of them. Embryology was another. Frank Lilly, for example, was most excited about how an egg develops, and he studied sea urchins and discovered how the sperm entered the egg, and other sperm were prevented from getting there. It's a major discovery, and so embryology was very important.
And, were those just kind of the topics of the day?
The topics of the day involved both evolution, which developed here, In fact, the first Nobel Prize won by an MBL scientist was Thomas Hunt Morgan of MBL in Colombia, who discovered literally that genes are in chromosomes, and that was done in fruit flies. That ain't physiology. That's modern genetics. Lilly, embryology. Courses have been added. Physiology was almost the parent course, and that was founded by Jacques Loeb. There's a building named after him, and he and Whitman, of course, are major figures at the University of Chicago. Loeb came from the University of Chicago. Whitman went to the University of Chicago from the MBL.
Now, you mentioned that discovery that genes are on chromosomes, and of course, if we fast forward now to the mid-20th centuries, the 1950s, the 1960s, MBL was really part of the heyday and birth of molecular biology.
Perfect. That's exactly what happened. In 1953, Watson and Crick described the double helix. After looking at X-ray diagrams provided accidentally, one might say, by Rosalind Franklin.
And that's a story for another day.
The summer of 1954, all three of them were here at Woods Hole. 1954. There was an exhibition on the summer of 1954, which is on the MBL archives page.
Well, and I've seen one of those photos. I mean, it makes Watson and Crick, these scientists, look like rock stars. There's a picture at one point of one of them, I'm not sure which, on the beach, surrounded by a circle of young women in bikinis, kind of with adoring faces. And you kind of wonder if this was really science going on or just kind of summer camp.
Don't forget, what happens at summer camp? People fall in love with each other, but also the subject matter. The MBL is a summer camp for science, where people fall in love with science and each other. Many people I know have gotten married as a result of this encounter. But let's get back to 54. Watson and Crick discovered the double helix of DNA, and they said this immediately suggests a copying mechanism. But what did it suggest? No one knew. And that same summer, Matthew Meselson, just coming from Caltech, a student of Linus Pauling, was a teaching assistant in a physiology course. He met a student named Frank Stahl, and outside the mess hall, they decided to do the experiment which would test how DNA replicated. It was called the most beautiful experiment in biology. And the Meselson-Stahl experiment, conceived at the MBL, two people came together from nowhere else, arose as a result of the summer of 1954 when everything seemed to take off.
Wow. In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Jerry Weissman of NYU and MBL about the history of the Marine Biological Laboratory, which is celebrating its 125th anniversary this year. We'll have more after a short break.
One, two, three, four, five. I bet I bought 10 pairs of binoculars. I bought my family each a set.
Roy Reining, on the beach in Truro.
Yeah, I got my first pair. I think I was 6 or 7. I still have those. Old pair of Japanese binoculars. My grandmother gave them to me. On my father's side. She lived down here. Over the years, you'll see just about anything you can imagine, from stunts that young kids pull to wardrobe malfunctions that older people have in the surf. You spend the time looking through the glasses and you'll see things.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
Well, I've been doing this for how long? I don't know. 30 years? Maybe longer? Well, I guess I didn't realize it, but I'm quite the binocular guy, aren't I?
I'm Jay Allison, here to tell you we still have room for another local storyteller for WCAI's Big Moth Night this summer on the Vineyard. Pick up the phone or go to the web to pitch us your story for a chance to join Adam Gopnik, Jenny Allen, Buddy Vanderhoop, and more for a night of great storytelling at the Tabernacle in Oak Bluffs on August 3rd. Go to themoth.org to find out more and record your pitch. That's themoth.org. Hope to see you there. Thanks.
Welcome back to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking about the Marine Biological Laboratory, which is the oldest continually operating independent marine lab in the country, celebrating its 125th anniversary this year. And with me is Dr. Jerry Weissman, Professor Emeritus at New York University and a longtime affiliate of the MBL. We were talking before the break about the heyday of molecular biology, kind of the birth of molecular biology and the role that MBL played. And you're listing off these names, Watson and Crick, and it just, you know, some of the biggest names, and this, you know, goes back to the founding of the institution too, some of the biggest names in the history of science, all affiliated in some way with MBL. What is it about MBL that draws people from all over the world for these summer courses and for the summer research experience?
Well, when you look at our website, you'll see that there are 51 Nobel laureates have worked or taught here.
51.
51.
That's huge.
It's 125 years. That averages like one every other.
One every other year. That's pretty impressive.
And if you take a look at what the affiliation is, it comes from having been a student like Paul Greengarden in embryology, just having a lecturer, but by and large, many worked here. And what does it is the association. Science is the product of buzzing minds. People come together, talk, and ideas explode. They explode better in an informal setting, rather than in the standard, rigid routine of university teaching. Part of it is the fact that there are no bars erected at all for personal communication, whether it be the beach, the tennis court, the poker game, the long walks, the sail, and above all, the chat in the library where you look things up together.
So, in fact, this summer camp kind of aura is actually really important to the success of MBL.
Lao Tzu, the Chinese philosopher, said the aim of philosophy is to regain the child's heart. At Woods Hole, scientists, natural philosophers, regain that sense of wonder and excitement that brings them all together.
Now, in recent years, MBL has made a transition from being just a summer institution to having year-round research going on. I wonder how much the culture of the institution has changed. Do we now get that explosion of wonder year-round, or is there still a very different feeling during the summer?
The relationship between year-round research, which is excellent, and summer research, which is unique, has always been a source of discussion. We now have marvelous full-time scientists year-round. But the unique, which is true for a lot of institutions, the unique aspect of the MBL is that it is centered around teaching. We began as a children's school of science. The fact that there are students from all over the world coming for the summer courses, from Japan, from Italy, from France, from Germany, from Sweden, from the Asian countries, that's what makes us unique. Now that we're going to affiliate with the University of Chicago, this will expand that teaching aspect and will make it even more exciting.
Now, there are all these traditions. You know, you mentioned the beach and the tennis court, just kind of going out and playing. But there are also, like coming up this week with the 4th of July, there's always a 4th of July parade where many of the students that are involved in the courses that are here on July 4th dress up as whatever it is they're studying, whether that's a bacteria or a fish or any other organism in between. Some of these traditions, to me at least, seem like they might not fly at perhaps a newer institution, that they have a little bit of weight to them because people know that they have these long histories, these decades-old histories, that they're kind of throwbacks. You know,
it's going to not only will it continue, but it will flourish. Now that you'll have more students coming in from the Middle Western School, and this will attract many, many more scientists and students, the traditions continue. There'll still be baseball games between embryology and physiology. There'll still be dances and movies at the MBL Club. And let me give you a good reason why. A number of new courses have developed in the last few decades. Parasitology, Frontiers in Reproduction, or one I was involved with, the Ellison Medical Foundation, the Colloquium on Aging. The people who come for these specific ones are just as excited about the annual 4th of July parade and similar events as those of us who've been here for a while.
Now, many of these courses, I know, create songs about their subject matter, about their science. Do you have any idea where that tradition came from?
The singing as a tradition predated radio and television. It was how people amused themselves around campfires or if you will, at at lobster parties on the beach. There's much less of that going on now. Everybody has pads and pods, and so there's much less singing. The songbooks are historic, but not current.
Well, that is a shame. I've learned one or two of those songs myself, and they...
It's a long way from Amphioxus.
It is a long way from Amphioxus. That's one of the ones that I've learned at Amphioxus.
But that's a World War I song, remember.
And Amphioxus, enlighten us, Amphioxus is...
Amphioxus is halfway between a vertebrate and a fish.
So this is a song about evolution.
Exactly.
But it's there are not many of those floating around.
But it was a World War I song. It's a long way from Tipperary. I would also point out that there's been no war song since World War II. And many scientists believe that if you can't sing about a war, don't fight it.
An interesting note there. Now, MBL, in addition to the research that's going on here, there are a couple of resources that are really resources for the entire scientific community internationally, one of them being the archive at the MBL Huey Library. So this is a library that's shared, at this point anyway, between the Marine Biological Laboratory and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, obviously started with just MBL since Huey wasn't here yet. What's in that archive and why is it so important to the scientific community?
The MBL Oceanographic Library, Woods Hole Oceanographic Library, the MBL Wuhui Library, if you will, is one of the treasures of the country, if not the world. Not only does it have printed material that dates back to the beginning of much of the printed works of science that exist, but also their unique treasures, visual, literary, and also acoustic. There are recordings in that library.
What are the recordings of?
Recordings of interviews, etc. But that's a minor part. The main part is this enormous file that's been left by great scientists who've worked here, who've given their papers and their documents to the MBL. The MBL archives, in addition, has been the source of many displays that are shown all over the Marine Biological Laboratory and in the MEGS room of the visual resources, works by Haeckel, Leuckart, the greatest scientific illustrators. There are books in the archives that people would die for, but you can look at them with the permission of a librarian.
Now, are these actual scientific resources where researchers would be going and looking at these notes of previous researchers, or are these more of a historical resource
both,
at this point?
Both. Science can also be done by studying books. As you come into the library, there's a big sign over Louis Agassiz's name, says, "Study nature, not books." Well, that was all right if all you were doing was classifying things, which is what they did in 1888. That's known as taxonomy, classification, looking. It's completely valuable.
So basically just going and picking up specimens
and
figuring out
as
what they
the
are and what
they're
related
School of Science. To. But the real kicker that has happened since the end of the 19th century is experimental biology. That means you set experiments to test hypotheses. And then, to quote Eugene Bell, after whom a Center for Regenerative Medicine said, when he saw the sign "Study Nature, Not Books," Eugene Bell told me, "Study books, you'll learn more." And those books are in our library.
Well, the "Study Nature, Not Books" saying, I've always found kind of interesting that this is the Marine Biological Laboratory, and yet there's very little ocean-going research that comes out of MBL, or at least it's not an institution that sends out a lot of boats to do a lot of ocean-going research.
Well, we've sent MBL scientists to the deep, deep abysses of the ocean together with the oceanographic scientists, and we sent at least two of them, of our scientists, have been up in space, not to speak of MBL. So we've gone from top to bottom as you can go. As to ocean, of course there's ocean work because we work on the ecology. The Echo Center, one of the best places in which to study the ecology of our planet, studies the ocean and what is happening to it as we pollute it with nitrogen. Moreover, people from the Echo Center and people studying the ecology of seashore and ocean life has gone from the Arctic to the Antarctic. In fact, some people have accused its members of being bipolar.
Oh, the jokes and the puns are running this morning. Okay, the Marine Resources Center. This is another one of those resources drawn on by the entire scientific community, for collecting organisms that might be used for research anywhere in the nation or the world. Where did that get its roots?
The collecting duct. Namely, it's not the kidney, but it was the place where all of the stuff that was brought in from the boats that we have that collect specimens, they had to keep them in tanks. These have to be temperature controlled, seawater has to be monitored, and the fish, clams, oysters, sea urchins, squid
have
to be separately housed and taken care of, and that's the marine resources. And people from all over the world can draw upon the Marine Resource Center to get specimens if they wish. However, it also houses a research facility. In fact, one of the finest bits of work on marine camouflage is being done in that building.
Yeah, absolutely. There's fabulous research going on in there all the time with those organisms. But then, as you said, some of those organisms are being sent off to researchers elsewhere as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, let's talk a little bit. We already mentioned that MBL is forming this new collaboration with the University of Chicago. Where did that come from? What is the impetus for this affiliation?
Well, in order to do modern science year-round, and for that matter in the summer, you need a constant supply of undergraduate, graduate, and postdoctoral fellows and students. Nowadays, independent research institutes need a university to supply that stream of ideas, youth, and energy. So that's the main impetus. For example, most other independent institutes, for example, Scripps, which is very close to the University of California at San Diego. Rockefeller was an institute, but it had to become a university in order to have that stream. We're simply following suit in that line, namely affiliation with a stream of younger people, teachers, etc., to enlarge the possibilities of collaborative work, which is required in the era of big data and lots of information available to handle at one time. Moreover, it's almost impossible for small independent research institutions, not funded entirely by the federal government, as the Oceanographic is, to make a living. For us to join the University of Chicago as an affiliate is a privilege for both institutions, I believe. I speak as an inhabitant of another institution. I wish NYU had done this, but Chicago was lucky enough to arrange this, and the MBL was lucky enough to have Chicago. Back to our roots. Remember, Whitman, the first director of this of the MBL, was whisked off to become a professor at the University of Chicago, which was founded in 1893, 5 years after the MBL. People frequently say that Chicago professors founded the MBL. Other way around.
And we've kind of come full circle.
Exactly. For the first four decades, the directors of the MBL have been University of Chicago professors. And everyone has been delighted with the arrangements. The university is spectacular. It has resources in engineering, solid-state physics, biocomputer applications that we need. And I think we can help them in terms of broader international outreach. And above all, a seacoast with salt in it.
Well, yeah, that's the marine part of things. But a few years ago, actually, the Marine Biological Laboratory went through a bit of a rebranding campaign to become officially the MBL and try to actually de-emphasize that marine part of the name and the reputation.
I don't think that was the impetus at all. NYU didn't give up being a university. MIT didn't give up being a technology school just because it became an abbreviation. MBL is an abbreviation. We're still the Marine Biology Laboratory.
All right. Well, a caller points out that HUI is not entirely funded by the government. That, of course, is true. Both HUI and MBL are Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and the Marine Biological Laboratory are entirely what we would say soft money institutions, that they're dependent entirely on grants, right? There's no, as there would be at a university, endowment or student tuition to keep them going. Does that change at all with the University of Chicago affiliation?
That remains to be seen. I'm not sure. And by the way, the call is completely correct. I'm simply suggesting that the agencies that fund the Oceanographic Institution may be a little bit more permanent than the grants from the National Institutes of Health.
Why is that?
The Department of Defense and people who work on physical oceanography are going to be around a bit longer.
Well, and of course, that is a portion of where the Oceanographic gets their funding, but certainly not.
No, not
certainly not all of it.
Not at all. No.
Now, excuse me. We've talked a little bit about the founding of the institution, and you were making the point actually before we went on the air this morning that women have been incredibly important in the history of MBL. I found that really interesting.
Of the four founders of the MBL, one of the founders was Cornelia Clapp, also then at the University of Chicago. That's one out of four. Women constituted half of the population of teachers at the Penike School and the Annisquam School. The MBL's first classes had at least half women because of the Women's Education Association of Boston, of which Elizabeth Cabot Carey Agassiz was a major figure. And women were, you can see them all over the pictures early on. My favorite one, of course, is that of Gertrude Stein, who was here. And in her class, you see many women collecting fish or on a collecting trip off Quesset. Women have always been here. One of our two astronauts, Millie Hughes Fulford, is a woman. And I'm delighted to say that both the speaker of the corporation and our president is a woman. Joan Rudiman of Harvard is a woman. And it was in her laboratory that two Nobel Prizes were won.
So a long history of women at the MBL. It's fabulous. Absolutely. To hear. Dr. Gerald Weissman is Professor Emeritus and Professor of Medicine at the New York University, as well as Director of Biotechnology Study Center at New York University School of Medicine. He's the Editor-in-Chief of the FASEB Journal and author of several books about history and culture of science, and of course, a longtime affiliate of the MBL. Jerry, thank you so much for talking to us about the history of the MBL.
My pleasure.
You can see some historic photos from MBL on our website, including Women at Work. You can also find information about some of the celebrations going on this summer for the 125th anniversary of the MBL. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will be talking about the Children's School of Science. I'm Heather Goldstone. You're listening to Living Lab on The Point.
Another Science Minute.
Ants want to live in an indestructible house, so frequently it's a really, really difficult task to get at them. And sometimes it can take all day to follow a tunnel through the log.
Adam Lazarus, scientist at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole.
So much of the day is spent just walking around in the woods looking for a log. If it looks like one of those all-day kind of logs, sometimes I'd just as soon leave it be and say, good job, ants. I'm going to go for an easier one. Really, I love these ants. I admire them for what they do. I think of the colony as a single entity. There is no governance in the colony. The queen doesn't tell the workers what to do any more than the workers tell the queen what to do. And when I hack into that, right into the center of that, I have guilt. I have tremendous guilt. Sometimes ant parts come spraying out when I'm doing the chainsaw, and you see these ants kind of limping along and some of them picking up the dead and carrying them somewhere. And I definitely do my best to say, this is for science. We're learning more about the ants, and it's worth it for that reason.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.
Welcome back to Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. The Children's School of Science is celebrating its 100th year this year. Mary Ulbrich is a past president as well as a past science chair and a teacher at the Children's School of Science. She's also an alumni of the school. She's been coming to Woods Hole since 1942 and has family connections to both the Marine Biological Laboratory and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Mary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, just before the break, we were talking about the role of women in the history of the Marine Biological Laboratory, and that feeds right into the Children's School of Science, founded 25 years after the Marine Biological Laboratory, in part by the wives of some MBL scientists. It was basically founded by women of the Woods Hole community.
It was founded by four women, all connected with the science community, the Madames Warbassy, Morgan, Lily, and Crane. It was called the Dancing and Singing in Science School at the time, or that was the curriculum.
Dancing and Singing in Science. So they were they interpreting science through singing and dance, or were these separate parts of the curriculum?
Separate parts of the curriculum, as far as I can tell from the photographs that we have.
Why were those combined into one school?
The women wanted one of the motives for founding the school was to bring the children of the town and the children of the summer scientists together. And they thought the combination of the physical and social activities and the scientific activities would do this. Now, it didn't last very long. By 1923, it was the Children's School of Science.
So we'd gotten rid of the singing and dancing.
Yes.
That sounds a little unfortunate.
There is still a lot of singing and dancing in the science school, especially on the playground.
So did the school accomplish what it set out to do in terms of perhaps resolving? It sounds like there was some tension between the local residents and the summer science population.
No, I wouldn't say tension at all, just detachment. And to some extent, that still exists as children have more things to do. But as children in the community, Woods Hole community, as I understand it, found other things to do through the local schools, through camps, through other things to do. They sometimes were not looking to do something immediately in Woods Hole. Now, the science school also began with 6-week courses only. Today we have 3-week courses as well. And 6 weeks is a commitment.
It is a commitment during the summer, especially, I would say now, even more perhaps than 100 years ago, to be able to commit 6 weeks of your summer to one thing.
There are far fewer 6-week courses now than there are 3-week courses.
So talk a little bit about the curriculum. What kind of classes does the School of Science offer, and how much has that changed over a 100-year span?
It has changed in titles, so that when I went, I took birds and advanced birds, and now you do take ornithology. Some titles remain the same. Seashore life has been the same from the beginning. But it's also changed in substance, and Jerry Weissman was talking about that, so that we offer robotics, we offer microbial life. We offer experiments in Woods Hole today, as well as the insects, the seashore life, those courses like that.
Well, we have Simon on the line with us right now with his class from the Children's School of Science. It is the first day of school today. They are out on a field trip and ready to talk with us. Simon, are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
So where are you guys right now?
Where are we, guys?
Hey. Garbage Beach.
That's Garbage Beach.
Garbage Beach, which for those not from Woods Hole, is a small beach right across actually from the Marine Biological Laboratory, where due to the vagaries of ocean circulation, we tend to get a bit of trash washing up there. So what are you guys doing
today? So it's good.
What are you guys doing on the beach this morning?
Guys, what are we doing? Anybody? Dancing, what are we doing?
Looking for sea animals.
Looking for sea animals?
Looking for sea animals.
Uh-huh. What do you think, Gregory? What did we find so far?
Well, we found a starfish.
A starfish?
Yeah,
Sebastian, what do you think? What did we find? What's your favorite one?
A mussel.
A mussel. So we're actually doing a scavenger hunt, and these are just some of the things we found.
So how old are your students, Simon?
How old are you guys? About seven, right? Seven and eight?
Yeah.
Seven and eight.
Fabulous. And it, for most of them, is this their first School of Science experience?
Yes. This is the first class that most any science school student takes.
Fabulous. And are you guys having fun?
No. Are you guys having fun?
Yeah.
I mean, really, let them know.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, we're having fun, it looks like.
All right. Well, we will let you guys get on with your fun. Simon, thank you for calling us.
Oh, right on. See you later. Thanks a lot.
Now, the Agassiz quote that we talked about with regard to the MBL, study nature, not books, also, of course, has a very strong tie to the Children's School of Science. It's essentially the operating philosophy of the whole school.
Absolutely. There are books. When we went out on bird trips, you took a bird book to identify something you saw that you didn't know. But every teacher tries to get the class outside if it's possible and if the subject matter allows that.
Well, and I mean, this morning we've had downpours already this morning, but we're out on Garbage Beach.
Absolutely. You're going to be wet sneakers and nets, and the wet sneakers from walking in the water, and you can get some pretty wet T-shirts, too.
Now, we have some historic photos of the Children's School of Science that folks can see on our website as well. And one of my favorites, speaking of the wet sneakers, is this a black and white photo from probably close to 100 years ago. And so the women are wearing, in some cases, more of a knee-length skirt, in one case, a full floor-length skirt. Most of the men are wearing long pants, not shorts, and they're right out there getting wet. And you can just see they're soaked all the way up to their knees in, you know, what we would today consider probably your Sunday best kind of clothing. But they're right out there getting into it.
You know, I know that photo, and that's actually an MBL collecting photo. And the women truly are in leather boots and with their skirts tucked up. The early science school photos that we have from the 50s mostly, although we have a few earlier ones, have all the kids wading in sneakers, shoes were required, and jeans, because long pants were often required. So you came home with your jeans soaked to the knees and changed your shoes almost every day.
That's just part of the experience.
Part of the experience.
Now, who are the faculty at the Children's School of Science?
The faculty are hired, by the way, by the science chair, which is a pretty important position. And the faculty range from recent college graduates, very recent college graduates, who are studying science. We have quite a few faculty who have worked at or studied at the MBL or at HUI. And we have others who have heard about it and come. In the past, if you look back through all of the brochures, the ratio of PhDs to the BS in science was pretty close to even. Now that's not so true. We do have a lot of younger people teaching, but as I say, most of them have been involved. They've finished college. Most of them are in graduate work. Many of them have been involved with science in Woods Hole or other places for years.
Well, so obviously the requirement is more an expertise in the science than it is any sort of teaching degree.
Yes, and I'd like to say that we, the people who hire them, also I think try very hard to get people who are good with children. So as you heard with Simon, I mean, he clearly has this is the first day of class for him, and he obviously already has a rapport with the kids, and this is what we're looking for.
I had an experience several years ago. A friend of mine was teaching a course at the Children's School of Science where she was taking, I think it was more the 11 to 12-year-old age range, basically fishing off the dock. And the house I was living in at that point had a stand of bamboo next to it. Mm-hmm. And she came over one day and said, "I need bamboo." So we went out with some little saws and we chopped down 10-foot-long stalks of bamboo so that she could make fishing rods, so that the children would not only be fishing and have a relationship with the fish that they caught and were then going to dissect or identify, but they actually had a relationship with the fishing rod that they had used to catch them, that they'd made that fishing rod with their own hands. And in some ways seems very much a throwback to probably several decades ago, but I think really helped create a connection for the children.
Oh, absolutely. And I think particularly the Seashore Life classes who go fishing. Julie Child, one of our greatest teachers who taught biological illustration, which was her expertise, but also taught Seashore Life, would take her kids to the dock and they would all have usually a drop line, which they would just drop in, and whatever you pulled up is was what you caught that was interesting. Then John Valois, also from the MBL, taught the Fishes and Fishing course when it first started. And there we finally moved into real fishing rods.
So that's a significant step up in the world.
In, well, some thought, though.
So talk about your experience as a student of the School of Science. What courses did you take, and which ones perhaps stuck with you the most?
I started with Seashore Life, and indeed there's an exhibit over at the Woods Hole Historical Museum now. One room is on the MBL, and one room is on the Children's School of Science. And there is a picture of me holding up a coffee can, which is what we collected in at the time, looking very happy, and that's Seashore Life. So I started there in the 1940s. The other classes I remember were insects, which was called insects instead of entomology then, because it was such fun. You tore across the fields with nets. You had a killing jar. This was very exciting, to have a killing jar that you made yourself. You then learned to pin the insects. And indeed, there's there are two Riker mounts over there with insects from 20 years ago that are still reasonably well preserved. Certainly, I remember birds. That included an early morning bird walk. usually about three quarters of the class would be able to show up at the early morning time.
How early are we talking?
6:30.
It's pretty early.
It was pretty early then, even though science school started a half hour earlier then than it does now. But being awake and alert and listening, and of course the teacher, who was wonderful, would say, listen, there's a whatever it is. And we'd all listen. And of course you'd hear six birds, eight birds. It's very noisy here in the morning if you get up. Lots of birds. And she would be able to identify the precise one and then mimic it. And that's how we learned.
Now, you yourself went on to become a high school teacher, but of English, not of science. But then you've come back and you've been very involved in the School of Science. So what influence would you say your experience as a child, as a student of the School of Science, had on your career choices?
Oh, the excitement that I felt I wanted my own children to feel. And they both went through science school, became lifers, became assistants at the science school, and now my two grandsons come up to go to science school. So the excitement as well as the history and the knowledge. Where else do you go to a beach and have kids talking about the crepidula they're finding instead of, you know, what's that worm or whatever it is that they're looking at?
Now, I know there are a lot of our listeners who have probably been through the School of Science. If you've been through Children's School of Science, give us a call. Tell us, what was your favorite class and what influence has it had on you? 866-999-4626 is the number to call to share your Children's School of Science stories. I mean, a lot of alumni of the Children's School of Science do go on to careers in science, and quite illustrious careers in science. It's what is it about that this experience that is so impactful, so influential?
Well, you know, one of the interesting parts of that is that Bettina Dudley, who taught at the Children's School of Science for years, did her doctoral thesis on the Children's School of Science. And she did ask that question. She sent out several hundred questionnaires and got a 50% return, which is really quite good about that. And people spoke about the excitement generated from the Children's School of Science and from being in Woods Hole. And I think no child is immune to what else Woods Hole offers for science, from folk singing to eel pond to watching the boats go out to collect things to the aquarium that we have here. And then the going to school for a short time and loving it. As I quoted in a comment I'd written about it, you go to school in the summer and you like it, which is what kids have said to my children, to other children. The connection is clear, but also the reason for the excitement, I think.
So there's kind of the spillover of that MBL Summer Camp for Scientists enthusiasm just infects the whole community and the children as well.
And what child really doesn't like catching something that squiggles?
It's true. with three boys of my own, I can tell you that my 6-year-old son this year is in a state of anticipation for next summer when he gets to start the Children's School of Science.
Very good.
Now, the School of Science was founded in 1913, obviously 100 years ago. It was a few years later, if I have my educational history right, that Waldorf School was first founded. And I know the Children's School of Science has its roots kind of in the progressive movement, and you were talking about this trying to bring the community together, involving the action, the singing, the dancing. That's kind of a similar thing to Waldorf. What was going on in the culture, the broader culture, that really pushed people towards this educational style of singing and dancing and moving instead of just sitting at a desk?
As far as I know, and from reading the articles and the new book that's come out on the Children's School of Science, there is no formal connection, although quite a few of our teachers have had connections with the Waldorf School here in Cape Cod. But the idea of learning through doing, which is paramount at MBL, at Children's School of Science, at most really active and lively schools today, whether they be public or private, I think, and I can't go beyond that in answering that question, because there's no specific connection that I know of.
Now, you mentioned earlier the robotics class,
mm-hmm.
and this seems to stick out. I don't want to say a sore thumb, but it certainly sticks out among the offerings. We have these offerings that have been there since the very beginning of birds and fish and the natural world, and then we've got robotics. So how does that fit into this, to the broader curriculum and to the philosophy of the school?
Let me read you the description. It's for children ages 13 to 15. And it says, students will focus on the technical, economic, environmental, and social aspects of real-world marine engineering and electronics. Frequent field trips and data analysis will be used to study propulsion and energy. What child doesn't like propulsion and energy? And indeed, if you were fortunate enough to be walking past the eel pond or occasionally the swimming pool out at the motel here and watching some of the projects that these students have made and watching them put them in the water and see if they will go and understanding why they will go or not. And you realize, okay, this is tremendously exciting. It says they're going to explore the physical principles behind modern marine technology.
So do you, you know, so you say most of the children are very excited about school, but do you ever have a child or children who come in and are a little bit perhaps world weary that, you know, this is just fish, this is just birds, let's, you know, get into the real world, you know, our iPhones and whatever else we've been doing, the technology that we're used to in daily life. Where is that in the offerings at the school?
Sure. And I think that's a two-part question. I have to commend our three administrators. We've had three, and Doug Jones is our current administrator, because a teacher who finds a student who seems disenchanted or not really buying in at the beginning will often send that student out to our administrator. And, you know, there could be a lot of reasons. Sometimes it's language. We have kids from all over, and they may just not understand English. Sometimes it is kind of the ennui of the 14-year-old who's never been to science school and doesn't feel he's bought into this, or a stranger who doesn't know anybody. And the teacher and Doug working together, or our two previous administrators, will try to make the student feel more comfortable, more excited about it. Usually all it takes is one field trip when you're actually out there getting something, doing it.
It's getting out there and doing it is all it takes. Well, Mary Ulbrich is served as a president and also the science chair at the Children's School of Science. That school is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year. Mary, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can find historic photos of both the Marine Biological Laboratory, which is celebrating its 125th anniversary, and the Children's School of Science, which is celebrating its centennial, on our website, as well as links to information about the celebrations that both institutions are holding this summer. Thanks all for listening. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. You can find Living Lab Radio all week on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Michael and Roxanne Zack. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.